Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 27th, 2006. Our session today is entitled Vital Communities, Social Capital, and Congregations: How Our Relationships Matter. Our presenter is Jody Kretzman. Session number KRJO 2006-2. Let's listen in.
Good. Well, it's a great luxury to have the opportunity to have some small group discussion around some of this stuff. So let me try to briefly lay out a few things and then open it up for you all to bring us into conversation about your particular setting and challenges. My name is Jody Kretzman. I come from Chicago. That's my son Marcus, who just came in, who works here as the painter. We've been coming up to Holden Village for about 30 years. Most summers, and the rest of my time is spent in local communities, mostly struggling communities, challenged communities, in cities across North America, and now our work is on 6 different continents. What we're trying to do constantly is to learn from communities and community folks what works to strengthen communities, what works to make them more vital, what works to include more people in them. And I have to say that a lot of the most important lessons in my community development, community building life have come from Holden Village. Holden has been a critically important place for me to sort of watch and figure out what makes community work here, particularly when people are constantly coming up the hill and going down the hill. How do you make that kind of a transient set of relationships powerful for everybody here? So my classroom has not been entirely urban America or struggling rural America or the developing world, but some good dose of Holden Village in the middle of it, right? Yesterday, I tried to do a quick introduction to what we've called asset-based community development, ABCD. I direct an institute called that, Asset-Based Community Development Institute, at Northwestern University in Chicago. And we work with communities across North America and including Canada, lots of work actually in Canada, and now globally, to figure out what are the secrets, what are the strategies, what are the approaches that make strong communities work. And yesterday we summarized a little bit when we collected our major book, probably, is called Building Communities from the Inside Out. And the content of the book is 250 stories or cases, I suppose, arranged in a way where the lessons of the people who were doing successful things in tough situations, where the lessons become evident. So there are lots of cases in here of schools being turned around in inner city neighborhoods, of parks being taken back from the drug dealers, of kids and gangs being sort of brought into more constructive community life, all of the ways in which people were working at making successful things happen in tough situations. We spent a lot of time in the 25 largest cities in the United States, in the most challenged neighborhoods in those cities. We spent a lot of time in Native people's reservations, talking to Native people who were trying to change life on the reservation. We spent a lot of time talking with people in rural places, Midwestern communities where the farming economy had evaporated, Appalachian communities where the coal mining economy had been turned around. And what we were doing there was collecting these success stories, trying to figure out what worked. And the central lesson always was, if you found something good happening, and we found over 3,000 of these stories, if you found something good happening, there was always somebody at the center of what was happening that understood when she or he reached a fork in the road. And they had a choice to make. Either they could think about their community the way the major institutions in their area had told them to think about it. And that is, as a collection of needs and problems and deficiencies. So if you were in an urban setting, you would be thinking about your community as if this was its reality, this was its only reality, a set of needs and problems and deficiencies that that defined the community. And the problem with this way of thinking about a community, one of my best teachers said, if this is your only map to the community, you have been put into a prison, right? And it's a prison made up of what other people are thinking about your community. I always introduced yesterday, and I never go any place without this half full, half empty glass, right? Which reminds people all the time, I think, of the truth, both individually and in communities, that we're all like the glass. We've all got fullness, skills, capacities, gifts, experience, knowledge. But we've also all got problems, right? We've all got difficulties in our life. We're all a combination of these two things. And most of the time, what works with individuals is what works with communities, and that is focusing on the full part of the glass, not ignoring the empty part, not ignoring this, but starting with that. And so what we've been delighted to discover in the last number of years is that lots of people have recognized that this is not the map that leads to development, to health, to vitality, but that they needed an alternative map, which lots of communities have been very serious about constructing. That's a community assets map. What do we have that's in the full part of the glass? And I suggested yesterday that if you looked at rural communities and urban communities and small ones and large ones, you would always find, and this sort of surprised us, that no matter what the size of the community, you will find five kinds of assets, five kinds, categories of strengths or resources to discover, invest in, and connect. And this is not rocket science, but it's a way of sort of thinking about what is a community. What's it made up of? It's made up of the people who live there, thought about as filled with skills and gifts and capacities, not just with problems, right? It's a place where there are all kinds of networks and associations and relationships, and that's the place I want to sort of concentrate some of our discussion today. It's a place where you've got all kinds of institutions, paid places where people do the work, like public institutions like schools and parks and libraries and police, but also private businesses and nonprofits. And then fourth, every community has a set of physical assets. Whether you're rural or urban, there's the space and the land and the river that runs through it. And then you've got economic assets. Even in the poorest communities, people produce stuff. People consume stuff. There's barter going on. And so what we briefly, what we think community development means is finding these assets, connecting them, and then harnessing them to some kind of a vision for the future, right? And that's the process that we're sort of working with people across the globe to figure out. What I want to do today briefly, we then spent some time yesterday on a couple of quick examples about ways in which so many big institutions in our culture focus on the negative, focus on the problems. And I showed briefly an interview from a welfare department which asked the person on welfare who was trying to move from welfare to work all of the questions about what the obstacles are there. Bad health, no family support, no GED or high school diploma, all the stuff that's wrong rather than any of the stuff that's right. And then we showed some examples of people who have asked the other kind of question. Tell us about what you can do. What are you most passionate about? What are your interests? We showed a little example from a soup kitchen, which is one of my favorite examples of all time, where people in the soup kitchen ask the people coming in for a meal about three things: your gifts and your skills and your dreams. And when they asked the people in the soup kitchen about their gifts and their skills and their dreams, it totally transformed the soup kitchen, because people began revealing who they were, what they loved to do, what their skills were. And they found that most of the people there had cooking skills and didn't want to necessarily have other people cooking for them. They wanted to be part of the cooking team so that they were contributors to the community, not just takers from the community. So we sort of developed a vision yesterday briefly about what a good community is. A good community is one in which everybody gets recognized for their gifts and skills and gets asked to contribute them. And that's one of the things that Holden is good about. You know, Holden is good about asking people, what do you like to do? What are you good at doing? And can you give us some of what you've got? So that's where we were yesterday. What I want to do today briefly is to visit the second category here, what we're calling here associations, and see if we can relate that to some of the experience that you all may have in congregations or in communities and in your own kinds of settings. Let me take a quick detour. One of the things that has struck us, those of us in the sort of community development, community building field, is that there's more and more evidence that unless the local community and people who live in a local community are at the center of problem solving, nothing ever gets solved. So if you're importing solutions, If the solutions are all from the outside, programs and experts and money from the outside, nothing's going to happen. Let me give you a quick couple of examples. When we ask people in communities of all kinds, what's the kind of community you'd like to live in? What are the characteristics of the community you'd like to live in? They'd say things like, well, we'd like to have a safe community, right? Or we'd like to have a healthy community, or we'd like to have a community where kids are valued and where there's wonderful stuff for kids to do. Or we want to have a community where families are supported, or we want to have a community where it's possible to make a living. All of that, I think, has led us to rethink how that stuff, those good outcomes, those good ends, gets produced. Who produces it? So quick story. A few years ago, we've got this little shop, and we're sort of community development, community building people, and we started getting calls from strange places, at least what we thought were strange places. Places, Bob, like the American Medical Association and the American Hospital Association and the American Academy of Pediatrics started calling us up. And we're not health people, right? Why are you calling us? We asked. And they would say, well, we think we want to talk to you guys, but we're not sure. And we would say, well, what about? And they would not be able to answer us. And I don't know about you, but I like going into meetings sort of knowing what the meeting's about, right? So you have some idea what the conversation's going to be. But they couldn't tell us. And so we went over to some colleagues at Northwestern University who were in the medical school and in the research end and asked them to help us out here. Why is the American Medical Association calling up people who have nothing to do with health, we thought, but everything to do with communities? And they said, well, if you read these 7,000 volumes in this library on epidemiology, you would understand. And I was not about to read 7,000 volumes in a medical school library, and so I was about to leave and decide that this visit was not very helpful when a couple of friends decided that they would take compassion on us, and they reduced these 7,000 volumes to one overhead, which I'll now show you. And the overhead is about, where does health come from? How do we produce healthy people, right? And here's what they say. If we had read the 7,000 volumes, we would understand where health came from. What determines whether or not you and I, over time, are healthy people? Now, let's be clear here. Genetics and biology aside, genetics and biology are obviously critical, but what else produces healthy people, right, if you set the genetics aside? Here's what they said, five things, and this won't be rocket science either. They say, first of all, your personal behavior. Have you stop smoking? Do you exercise? Do you eat healthy foods? All of the things that lead to health. Secondly, our social relations. Are we embedded in family and an extended family and neighborhood and church? Ways for, it turns out, both mental health and physical health are stronger when we've got these kinds of social relations. And third, they said, it's the physical environment. Can you breathe the air? Is the water safe to drink? Is the food safe to eat? Do you live with rats and roaches? Fourth, they said, your economic status. When you need to enter the marketplace, can you get what you need to live a healthy life? And fifth, they said, it's access to hospitals and doctors and nurses and all of the medical care apparatus. When you're sick, can you get to quality health care? And those, they said, are the five things that if you read the literature would answer the question, where does health come from? Let me ask Dr. Bob Niedringhausen, who knows all of this stuff. Is this a list that you could live with?
Yeah.
Okay. Sometimes people would add a spiritual dimension that leads to health, but maybe that's embedded in here someplace. Anybody else? You're studying to be a nurse. Are you okay with this list? Okay. One of the things that we began noticing then about the list is that it's a very interesting list in terms of who's got the answers to these things, right? Who's got the key to changing these things in healthy directions? We asked our friends in the medical school one other question. Could you tell us, we said, from a policy perspective, if we had limited resources, which one of these things should we invest in first? What's the most important determinant of health? And they said they couldn't tell us. They really were quite honest, and I like it when academics say, that, well, I don't know. We think there's a lot of them are important and they interact in interesting ways, but we're not quite sure. But they said we can maybe be helpful a little bit and tell you which is the least important. We do know that. We do know that if you wanted to eliminate one and concentrate on the other four, we could tell you which one that you might want to eliminate. Anybody got a guess? You got it. Access to therapy, absolutely. The one statistical thing I'll say today is it looks like in the literature that about 10% of the contribution to whether or not you and I are healthy people over our lifespan on average, again, genetics and biology aside, is whether or not we can get to doctors and hospitals, right? Where do we spend all of our time and energy and money when we're talking about health policy in the United States? Access to therapy. So we've got a vibrant discussion here about the least important determinant of health, right? Or understood a little bit differently, you could say what we've got in the United States, at least, maybe a little bit different in Canada, I'd like to hear what you think about that, is a vibrant discussion about sickness, not about health, about treatment, which I think is vitally important. We want to have that, obviously, but we don't have really a health discussion in the United States. If we had a vital health discussion and we wanted to talk to people about how to change personal behavior in healthy directions and how to strengthen social relations, how to clean up the physical environment and how to enhance people's economic status, I don't know about you, but the last place I would go for a vibrant discussion of those issues is a convention of the American Medical Association. Doctors don't know much about that, do they, Bob, in general?
No, and this stuff is laid on us. You know, we're supposed to talk about wellness, and we were trained to take care of sick people. That last 10%.
That's right.
And somebody else ought to be doing that.
Yeah, yeah. And if you really think about it, all of the literature about how to make these things more positive, these top four things, say, you know, it's a big set of social policies, but the core, the critical core of how to make those positive is whether or not the local community is activated, whether or not you've got peers who turn your behavior in better directions, whether or not you're embedded in local relationships, and congregations and blocks, whether or not local people, it turns out, you can't clean up the river unless people in the community through which the river runs are committed to help doing it, right? It's their river. And it turns out even you can't rebuild an economy without local energies being critical for it. So what we've got here is a whole set of potential and a lot of actual activity that sees the community, and here's one way of thinking about it, as the co-producer of health. Co-producer of health with perhaps the medical profession, right? The same thing, I would argue, is true of all of the other outcomes we just went through. You want stronger families, you've got to have not just therapists and people who treat the brokenness of families, but you have to have a community committed to co-producing a context in which families can thrive. If you want to have kids who thrive, you can't just have corrections officials and treatment people and social workers or even schools. You need a community. Hillary Clinton's famous phrase, a village to raise a child, right? One other real quick example. We now know from a number of really, really convincing studies that if we want to have safe communities, the last place to look for as a producer of safe communities is the police. In fact, the studies show that if you've got some other things holding equal and you've got a safe community and a not-so-safe community, that the safe community is characterized by two things. This isn't rocket science either. Residents who know each other, right? And particularly, it turns out to be important, do residents know each other across generations? Do young people and older folks know each other in the community? And secondly, residents who act together in public, who say it's okay to come off our porch together and to talk to those young guys on the corner, or it's okay to band together and clean up the rubble on that lot and make a community garden grow here, right? It's okay to raise the barn together. This, by the way, is a Harvard study, and they have to make, universities, research universities are wonderful at taking common sense phrases and making them pretty much incomprehensible. So the phrase here is collective efficacy. And so academics always say that the level of safety in the community rises with the level of collective efficacy, right? And so if you want to pretend you've read the Harvard study itself, you could say that to somebody. So all of this leads us back to, to the assets, and particularly to this second one, the relationships in communities. The jargon phrase these days is social capital. We know what human capital is. That's the sort of training and skills of individuals. But it turns out that it's critical to have social capital as well. Let me just say a little bit more about that. The name association, which we sometimes use, it's not a name that I would often use in a neighborhood context, but it was given to us by that strange hippie French count who visited us in the early 1830s, Alexis de Tocqueville, right? Probably the best book about American democracy ever called Democracy in America. And at some point here he says, Americans of all ages, all conditions, and all dispositions constantly form associations. This is in the 1830s. He's just traveled across the United States all the way to the frontier of Green Bay, Wisconsin. And then he goes from the frontier of Green Bay, Wisconsin, down through the South, and then he's riding back to Europe to talk about what he found. And this is what he found. They have not only commercial and manufacturing companies in which all take part, but associations of 1,000 other kinds, religious and moral and serious and feudal and general or restricted, enormous or diminutive. Americans make associations to give entertainments, to found seminaries, to build inns. They're talking about our church history here. To diffuse books, to send missionaries out. In this manner, they found hospitals. Where do hospitals come from? They come from voluntary associations, right? They weren't born as hierarchies of medical people, right? They were born out of the caring of communities together. Everybody forms a society. Wherever at the head of some new undertaking you see the government in France or a person of rank in England and the United States, you'll be sure to find an association. And de Tocqueville was so impressed by this that he was trying to persuade Europeans that this was the critical thing about American democracy, that you didn't have to be born into the aristocracy. You didn't even have to be elected, but you just had to get together with your neighbors to figure out how to board up a sidewalk, how to take the mud out of the main street, how to make a commercial strip come back to life. And this is basically what we found at the core of the 3,000 stories we collected in building communities from the inside out. There was always a group of local folks who were getting together to think about what's needed here to produce more health, to produce more jobs, to produce kids who thrive, right? And so that was our continuous finding. Fast forwarding to 2001, how many people here have heard the name Robert Putnam? Anybody know about the work of Robert Putnam at all? He is the person in the United States who has probably brought this discussion back in most effectively into the center of our attention. We've been involved in it as well. But Bob Putnam is at Harvard, and he wrote a book in 2001 called Bowling Alone. Right? Do you remember the title, Bowling Alone? Some of you have heard about that. It's a brilliant title. Let me give you a quick background. Bob Putnam is a political scientist, and he was for a long time interested in foreign affairs, and he took a long look at Italy in the 1980s and 90s. And what happened in Italy is that Rome decided, much like Washington, D.C. did in the 80s, to put some power outside of Rome and out into the regions of Italy, 12 regions of Italy, just like Reagan was doing here, taking power out of Washington, D.C. and putting it in state capitals and city halls and giving sort of decentralization, devolution, as those are the words that got used about that. And Putnam was interested in what happens when that happens. And he was looking at Italy, and what he found was that of the 12 regions in Italy that got new power, new authority, in 6 of them, it worked. And in 6 of them, it didn't, right? What he meant by worked was, did it strengthen the economy, and did it strengthen the democracy? Are more people involved in more serious ways in running things? And in 6 regions, it worked, and both democracy and economy grew, and in 6 regions, it didn't. And he said, why is that? What explains it? Is it that some of the areas are rural and some of them are urban? No, he decided that wasn't it. He looked very carefully at the causes. Is it that some of them have governments that are structured differently, or some of them are richer, or some of them are poorer? None of that worked. He said the only thing that worked to explain why some regions took off and other regions didn't was the number of soccer teams, right? And cultural groups, and women's groups, and reading groups, and youth groups, and all of the stuff that people come out of their doors to do together that they do without pay because they love to do it. And when you've got a whole lot of that going on, it's like you've got soil that's rich, that people have relationships with each other, that they know each other, that they trust each other. And then you can put a reform in from a government, and it blossoms. It's hit rich soil, and all of a sudden it just grows, right? And Putnam's conclusion in Italy was that that's the key thing. Where you've got this rich soil of relationships or associations or social capital, you've got all kinds of growth opportunities, all kinds of development opportunities. He came back then, Bob Putnam did, to the United States and said, we got to take a look now at where we are in terms of social capital, because de Tocqueville told us that we're the capital of social capital. It's where these associations are richest on the face of the earth. At least that was the case in 1832. Is it the case today? And so he wrote Bowling Alone, and mostly Bowling Alone is a lament. It's a kind of a cry for help, because what he concluded was that by a whole lot of measures in the last 30 years in the United States, people relate to each other less. That our associational life is withering in lots of ways. And that's a real problem. His image, Bowling Alone, is a wonderful image, because what he found was, in fact, Americans, at the time that he wrote the book in 2001, were booming bowlers. Everybody was getting into bowling. There were 10% more people bowling every year. But at the same time as more people were bowling, bowling leagues were disappearing, right? And bowling leagues is where social capital got formed. That was the relationships. That's where people got to know each other over time and create some trust. So people were bowling, but they were bowling alone. They were not bowling in leagues anymore that the steel mills might have formed, that the teachers union might have formed, that the nurses association might have formed, right? And he thought that was a huge problem. We have had an ongoing set of discussions with Bob Putnam and others about whether or not he's right, and I'm not sure he is, because for a lot of at least the lower income communities, I'm not sure that at Harvard, using national data sets, you can see what's actually going on at the street level in west side of Chicago or in Salishan in Tacoma or in some Seattle neighborhoods. And so we have been engaged in working with local neighborhood folks to see what you find if you're looking for local associations in local places. And here's one low-income community on the west side of Chicago where they took a look at what they had in terms of these voluntary groups, and here's what they came up with. We had this is a community of about 35,000 people, mostly African-American, not exclusively, 204 religious congregations, 59 other groups spun out of religious congregations, whether those are, you know, athletic groups or cultural groups, 35 music groups, 31 book clubs, 29 youth support, hobby, safety groups, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, for a total of 612 local associations. And we're not sure that looking at the national data that Bob Putnam was using, that he saw too many of these, because they don't show up in... You could get national data about Kiwanis clubs and Rotary clubs and all the animal groups, the moose and the elks, and you can get national data about parent-teacher associations and some of the more national kinds of groups. But can you find the local tutoring and mentoring groups, or the women's support groups, or men's support groups, or the retiree support groups, or the safety groups? We're not sure you can. So our first lesson... I want to real briefly summarize a couple of our lessons here and then open it up for you guys. Our first lesson is that in many communities, but this is particularly true in urban communities, but I think it's also true in some rural communities, if you're thinking about this part of what a community is, voluntary relational groups where trust gets built, where all kinds of social capital is invested in and created, the lesson is there's always more there than anybody knows. When we did this work with friends in this particular community on the west side of Chicago, they started showing around their lists of the groups that were here. Not just a summary like this, but the particular. Here are the names of the 200 religious congregations here. And the reaction from leaders in the community was they didn't know more than 5% of these groups. So it revealed to them a richness of relationships that they had no idea was there. The second reaction was when they showed it to residents, this kind of a list of all of these groups, the most common reaction was, well, that's pretty impressive. We've got a lot of groups, but where's mine? And so they began expanding this, and within a few months, the 612 grew to over 1,000 groups as people began adding their, because this is not an easy task to try to find all these very, very local groups. Why is that important? I want to say a couple quick things about why it's important and then open it up. I think it's important because what associations represent are a whole series of important community assets. They reflect the individual gifts and capacities of their members. They reflect the power of relationships, shared interests, common goals, local connections, actual leadership as well as potential leadership. They reflect energy, local knowledge, commitment. In so many neighborhoods and communities where we work, the first thing we hear from frustrated community leaders is, you know what our problem is? Nobody cares, right? Nobody will come out to the community meetings. Nobody wants to participate. And what I think we've discovered over and over again is people are, in fact, coming out of their doors to participate, but they're participating in things that they want to participate in, that they love to do. We love to sing together. We love to play sports together. We love to be part of reading groups. We love to support our young people, and we'll come out for that, but we're not going to come to any meeting that some community leader calls. We want to do what we want to do. So we are increasingly convinced that it's critical to get in touch with the energies that are represented by local communities and their associations. Let me do a quick thing that just to see if we can agree on what the distinction is here, and we think this is a critically important one, between two ways of organizing human activity, institutions and associations. We're talking now about the right-hand column and see how it differs. These are just a few of the ways. Institutions, we're talking about public ones, schools and libraries and so on, and businesses. And associations, we're talking about these voluntary ones. In institutions, you've got a wonderful way of getting some stuff done, and it's formal and hierarchical, and it's organized by specialty. Participation is paid. Efficiency is God. We do studies and data and surveys in institutions like schools and universities. The staff roles are managerial and professional. We want to control what's going on. And have a professional aura. And most often when we focus on people, they're customers or clients, consumers. In the associational world, that's just not the way it happens. You get together in living rooms, and the relationship is informal, and the membership determines the directions. Participation is unpaid and voluntary. We operate mostly participatory. People buy in, get their 2 cents in. We don't do very many studies. We tell stories and anecdotes. Our staff roles, if we have staff at all, is a broker, a facilitator. That's what a good pastor often is. The power orientation is not so much about control, but about consent. The aura is more familiar, and people act as citizens or members or contributors. It's important to have both of these things working in a community, right? Both are critical. You don't want to confuse one with the other. When I get on United Airlines to go back to Chicago in about 10 days, I want to be in this column, right? I don't want a meeting in the cockpit, right? Asking, where should we go next? Or, what button do you think we should press next? I want people to be in a system of control where they know what's going to happen, where the aura is professional. On the other hand, I'm not sure I want the hierarchy of United Airlines running my block club or being in the church discussion about how do we include everybody in the activities here. So we think that both are important, and that sometimes what happens is that this column hides this column, right? Fairly frequently I get asked to go into a community and people say, come and meet with the community, Jody. And when I get there, it's 30 wonderful people, creative people, but they're all there because they're paid to be there. It's the political leadership and the school principal and the police commander and the elected official. And 95% of the people who are over here don't get invited. And that's a real problem in community development, community building. The other thing, the last thing I want to say about associations is that they are important for two reasons. Number one, and I already sort of implied this, they already do, we would argue, most of the important community building work. Most of the important community building work doesn't come from human service agencies, doesn't come from health professionals, doesn't come from elected officials. It comes from people at the block level getting together to solve problems. Secondly, we are more and more convinced, and I'll give you a real quick example, that this is the area in communities where even more could be done if we got smart about asking, right? So I want to show you real quickly a simple study we did a couple years ago in an inner city community where people did a pretty thorough inventory of the associations they had, and they found 314 of them, and they sort of categorized them. Here's youth ones, here's health ones, here's cultural ones, here's block clubs, here's women's groups. And they found out that they had 21 categories. Are you following me here? 21 categories of groups. And they decided, let's talk to these 21, at least a representative group out of each of these 21 categories, and ask them some questions about what they do. What do you do? And what would you be willing to do? So they asked, they went to 21 groups, one out of each of the major categories. So that was the way they figured out what their sample was. And they asked first about some neighborhood projects. Here's some typical neighborhood projects, right? Lots of people work on beautification or working with youth or senior citizens or supporting families or working on neighborhood health and neighborhood safety. And look, out of the 21, how many have already done that? Let me just take youth as an example. 15 of the 21 say that we work with young people. Now, what's interesting about that is that if you looked at the 21 groups that they interviewed, you would say from their title, here are two groups that work with young people. They have something about young people in their title, right? But it turns out that 13 more groups without young people in their title work with young people. Do you see what I'm saying? There's an invisible set of activities that are community building happening in the associational world. Same thing with groups working on neighborhood health. Only one group out of the 21 you would have thought had anything to do with health. But 10 say they're working on health, right? When you sort of probe, what are you doing? We're particularly interested then in the second column. We haven't done work in this area, but we're willing. So in a sense, if you're following the language here, the second column represents unused social capital, where groups say, well, you know, four groups say, we haven't really worked with young people yet, but we'd certainly be willing to. Let's talk about how to do that, right? So this is a column of stuff, and then the final columns are unwilling or uncertain and not willing. Another quick couple of examples. There are a lot of issues in neighborhoods, particularly in struggling neighborhoods, but also in others, that usually get put in the category of things that agencies have to deal with, right? So here's a bunch of typical issues: teen pregnancies and child abuse, drug abuse, domestic violence, youth truancy, bringing people with disabilities into the community, bringing people out of jail into the community. And here, these same 21 groups get asked, have you done this? And the numbers are a lot lower, right? Although, again, a surprising number maybe have done something. Here's seven of them say they've done something with gangs, right? Youth truancy and gangs in communities. And again, only a couple of them would look like that if you just looked at their titles. But then look at column two. On average, about half of them say, we've never done anything yet about child abuse or teen pregnancy or drug abuse, but let's talk about how we can. We're willing to come out and do that. So that the unused social capital gets even larger. Let me give you one quick final example. There are a lot of ways that people think about redeveloping local economies, starting and attracting new businesses, buying at new businesses, investing in new businesses, buying at existing, having a buy local kind of campaign, improving the business climate. These are sort of typical ways that communities go at rebuilding economy. And here you see almost none of the groups have been self-consciously engaged in economic development in their local community. But look at the numbers over here. On average, about three-quarters of the groups, and again, these are sports groups, and their choirs, and their women's groups, and their reading groups, three-quarters of whom say, we'd love to be involved in rebuilding the economy here. So one of the things we've been really interested in is, how do we think about a choir as an economic development engine, right? A choir is a wonderful place for people to bring their skills together and sing together and magnify those skills. But what if the choir was thought about as a producer of jobs, as a connector of people without jobs to jobs, as a group that could sing benefits, as all the ways in which a choir could do things to build the economy. So our second lesson is, in addition to discovering and rediscovering the fact that people in local associational life already do critical work in community building, that they would be willing to do a lot more and that we just don't ask them. So a lot of the challenge for community building is, how do you activate the social capital that's already there? The last thing I want to say is, churches, local congregations, are the most critical center of social capital in any community. And they are the engine that produces more of it all the time. So that they are the soil out of which more and more relationships happen. And so we've been working hard to discover where local clergy and lay leaders have taken that task seriously and collected a bunch of their stories and tools in a book called Asset-Based Strategies for Faith Communities. And a lot of the stories and tools and approaches in this book are about how local congregations take themselves seriously as local associations and reach out to others. What are we as a collection of assets at this church, and how do we connect with assets in the community to make both us stronger and the community stronger? And those are the stories that we're seeing now multiply in all kinds of ways. So the little congregation on the west side of Chicago, a little Lutheran congregation called Bethel New Life, which started out as a dying congregation in a racially changing neighborhood, down to their last 30 white members, when the whole community begins to turn African-American around them, decides that they're going to stay, and that if they stay, they're going to have to change completely their relationship to the community. And so they decide one morning that the major need in the community is for affordable housing. And having just been through a riot or two in the late 1960s, they had a whole bunch of burned out buildings, and they decided what we could do is, after Sunday service, we could go down and sort of teach ourselves carpentry and plumbing and drywalling and rebuild that abandoned three flat at the end of the block. And they did that in 6 months. They then rented it out, and with the proceeds they bought another one, and they did it again. And now fast forward, they now have produced a new or rehabilitated over 1,200 units of affordable housing in the neighborhood around them. They are now a community development corporation with a $15 million a year budget. They employ over 800 people and find jobs for another 600 people every year. They're a beacon of light in that West Side community, all because they thought about, what do we have and how do we connect to the community in a useful kind of way. In another quick example, a church decided some of our major assets are our young people. Let's get them organized to connect with other young people who live around the church. And so they started calling them, I love this term, animators of the human spirit. And they designated a dozen animators of the human spirit every summer. And their job was to go out and find other young people and figure out what those young people love to do, do what we were calling yesterday a capacity inventory or a gifts interview with those people, and then facilitate ways to do it. So people who love to ride bikes got themselves together and got taught how to repair bikes and opened up a bike repair shop. People who had some artistic skills began gathering all of the broken glass in the neighborhood and spent 2 months putting together a huge, wonderful mosaic mural about the community filled with hope for the young people of the community. So there are examples constantly about ways that churches are figuring out how they can connect with the social capital around them and build more of it. My final example, anybody here from the Twin Cities? I guess not. Boy, that's unusual to have a Holden gathering with nobody from the Twin Cities. One of our favorite examples these days is from the Twin Cities, where about 6 years ago, a group of Catholic and Lutheran churches began noticing that they've got a lot more new neighbors, and a lot of these neighbors were coming from Mexico and Central America. They decided what we have to do is to get to know these new neighbors, and they began interviewing them and figuring out one of the things they really needed. There was no mass up to six years ago in the Twin Cities area, no mass in Spanish. And so they began to provide a couple of different options for people to experience mass in Spanish. And then they started noticing that almost all of the new neighbors were either unemployed, having trouble getting jobs, or underemployed, doing menial work for minimum wage at best. And they decided to talk with them about that. And they had a wonderful idea. They said, this is so radical, they said, what if we had the premise that our new neighbors actually had a life before they came to Minneapolis? That they actually did something in Mexico, they did something in Guatemala. And so they sat down and asked people to tell them about their lives and their interests and skills and enthusiasm. And their central question was an economic one. Have you ever done anything in your village in Mexico to make money? Make money on the side? Have you sold food, made tortillas and sold them, or made crafts or dresses or any kind of activity that was producing income for your family? And almost everybody they talked to had done something like that, had experience like that. Their next question was, well, would you like to sort of explore with us how to take what you know how to do in the old country and see if we could build something on it here? And so they then put together a process that lasted about 2.5 years. And then the result was what is now one of the great economic development stories in Minneapolis, something called the Mercado Central, the central market. As you know, if you've traveled in Latin America, a lot of Latin American cities are built around open markets that are commercial, but they're also social and cultural and celebratory. And Minneapolis now has one of those. Because it's Minneapolis, it's not outdoors, it's inside. They took over a huge industrial building, and that industrial building now has 55 small businesses in it, small enterprises made up of the dreams of the people and the experience of the people who came up from Central America and Mexico. And it's become the central economic hub of the Hispanic community, and it's become the sort of central community center for the Hispanic community. And now it's becoming a tourist destination for non-Hispanics in the upper Midwest, where people can come and have wonderful Latino food and buy terrific crafts and clothes and beautiful arts. And it is now the center of the rejuvenation of South Minneapolis. Right? So it's just the lesson of what can happen if you start, let me just end with... if you start moving from one column to the other, if you sort of decide not to start with the empty part of the glass but start with assets and capacities, if you're not concentrating exclusively on problems and pathologies and needs but on skills and talents and resources, if you're not always spotting problems and try to respond to them but you're also looking for opportunities, you're not focused on fixing people but you're focused on the community and social capital as the healing context. You're not focused entirely on charity, hold out your hand, community, and we'll give you programs and stuff from the outside, but on investment. We want to invest in what's here. You don't want to necessarily increase services because services are not needed in healthy communities. And you want to sort of build the kinds of relationships where people help each other and do things with each other and need fewer services. And you're not having so much emphasis on outside help, recognizing what's already inside the community. Is that clear? Great. Let's take a few minutes to gather either questions or stories or ways in which your own congregation or you're thinking about medical and health agendas or any other ways into your piece of this discussion. Well, two quick comments. I'm not sure I've got any formula. There is no formula here, I think. These are sort of perspectives and and hints about ways in which people have done this kind of work in the past. Relationships are critical here. So one of the things I'd be thinking about if I were you is, what is the way to build relationships with just a few people inside those gated communities who can be our guides, our validators, our legitimizers, our way in to those places. And you're at this transition point. I'd also be thinking about, is there a way of connecting these newcomers with what's already here? Relationships in that way as well. And I think the conversation that's most helpful to have is usually not a conversation about needs, but it's a conversation about interests, passions, what do you like to do best, what are you best at doing, can we as a congregation provide some space for you to do that, can we connect you with some other people who also are interested in that, are there ways to find some common ground for the newcomers and the people who are already there based on interests, capacities, and skills, and gifts, rather than on needs. I think the danger of a situation like you're in is to define the newcomers as people with resources and the lower-income folks who have been part of that community as needy and set up that kind of a relationship. I think the goal ought to be, how do you get both people, both groups, beginning to build relationships with each other that acknowledge and start with what their real interests and passions are. So we talked yesterday a lot about, lots of people are using versions of what we call in this work capacity inventories, or gifts or skills interviews, in some gated communities, the people who are the developers are interested in doing that, because people who are moving into the gated communities often are isolated and don't have relationships even within the gated communities with each other. And so in some places, people have used something like an interest interview or a capacity inventory as a way to begin building relationships. Aha, you're interested in golf, okay? Here are four other people who've told us the same thing. You might want to get to know them, right? They're your neighbors. And I think that those kinds of just sort of small steps all around relationship building are certainly where to start. And it needs to keep happening, too. It doesn't ever sort of stop. Is that, I don't know, that, is that okay?
What I see is really such a tension between downtown area where they border this low-income neighborhood, the Hilltop.
Yeah.
And I don't know how involved they've been in that neighborhood, but now developers are coming in. A lot of low-income housing is going away. They're building these million-dollar condominiums, and I see where this community is going to be that much more isolated. So.
Absolutely.
Because I see a big divide.
Yep.
And that same divide's happening in my... I live in a smaller suburb called University Place, and they're trying the economic, you know, to build economics with bringing in Banana Republic and Old Navy and all these higher-end stores. And meanwhile, the area I live in is an older part of town, and we're just kind of being left out of some of the development stuff. And so...
Yeah.
In both arenas that you somehow bring it together. And I think you talked about that, where people have this power and it's,
yes,
equalized.
Yeah. And part of the trick, I think, is you know, when you're not the area being invested in, is how do you change people's perceptions of who you are?
Exactly.
Right. one of my favorite stories of Pastor Ron Van Yek in Tacoma is what he did with the Salshan neighborhood. He was working in the lowest income neighborhood in Tacoma, and everybody thought of it as a place filled with needs and problems and deficiencies, and it's public housing, and it's a mess, right? That's the way people have always thought about it. But they were also, people from Pacific Lutheran and other places were constantly interested in coming in and studying it and, you know, trying to get to know it from the outside. And so Ron Vignette, the pastor there, started thinking about what was going on. And so he and a bunch of leaders from the neighborhood decided that they would name themselves the University of Salshan. Right? And so this was the place that you came if you were really interested in learning something. Right? And we, the residents of this public housing development, we are the professors. And we will. So it sort of turned everything on its head. All of a sudden, Salshan was a place that was you came if you wanted to learn. And the teachers were the residents. So some it's that it's, you know, that kind of a shift, I think, is sometimes wonderful to contemplate.
Having this assignment to go into this homeless clinic to do a needs assessment. I guess my first question for them would be, what's working well here? If I'm looking at the glass.
Sure. Sure. What's working well here? What things, and if you're doing it. Are you going to do individual interviews?
Yes.
Okay. Gifts, skills, and dreams. What do you like to do best? What are you best at doing? What are you really enthusiastic about doing? If you could be doing anything now, what would it be? Where are your dreams? Because that's the stuff that you can do something with. That's the stuff that you can build on and figure out, okay, what's it going to take? What are the connections to be made here? What are the supports that need to be here for you to get to where you want to go. I certainly would resist mightily, if I were you, the assignment to do only needs. Let's do needs and, both parts of the glass are real. So let's know about both of them. But in a sense, a needs survey, number one, a needs survey never tells anybody in the community anything they didn't know. A needs survey is always for somebody else outside, right? The other thing about a needs survey is, in a funny way, it's the map of the useless part of the glass. This is the useful part of the glass. This is what we need to know about if we're going to do something that's useful here. This is not useful stuff, at least not to the people who are in the community. So, whatever you can do to convince your folks to, let's do both, right? Because this is the part that attacks this part.
This particular congregation, what are its strengths? What are its strengths? Does it ever go into that, or is it all?
Oh, I think it's really a very, very important set of tools and approaches at the organizational level, whether it's a congregation or an association or a community. One way of going at that, well, is to do, we've got examples of all kinds here, to do an organizational asset map. Get serious about the people and their skills, the connections that people represent, the physical resources that this represents, all of the ways in which this is a collection, this congregation of assets. Another way of going at it is we have a sort of sister discipline called appreciative inquiry. Anybody here heard of appreciative inquiry at all? It's an interesting set of tools and approaches. It was sort of created by some people out of Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, and it came out of the corporate world. And the question was, how do corporations change, big corporations? And this guy, David Cooperrider, invented a way of having a conversation that starts, it sounds very simple, starts with the question, when were you proudest of this organization? When did you feel most valued in this organization? When was this organization working its best? And collect stories like that. Second part of the discussion then is, okay, here are 15 stories about when this congregation was best. What made that happen? What were the characteristics that led to this good thing that you just told us about happening? Third part of the conversation is, how do we make more good things like this happen in the future? Right? So it brings people into practical activity aimed at a hopeful future, but not pie in the sky because they've already experienced it, right? So it's asking questions in a congregational setting about when were you best? When were you proudest of this? When were you most faithful? And how can we do more of that in the future?
Well, and even like on a real practical level, I mean, one of the things that your church offers is space. I mean, you
have
space.
Right. Yeah.
And so for the condo association,
absolutely,
you know, do you need an eating space? You need a worship oak. Be glad to share our meeting space. I don't know if they have that kind of thing in the condo association where maybe they have to go places to meet, but maybe that might be really handy for them. And then just coming in and seeing your bulletin board to see what's going on and walking out is going to, you know.
Child care, a place for child.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
That's,
yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
Right.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
And then the kids and the kids from the other side of the community can both have good childcare.
Right, that
yeah.
would be remarkable
and the kids
if, that's,
friends,
if that's where they met.
Come together.
Yeah. Work together because
yeah.
your kids are friends.
Yeah.
Maybe the parents will be. Yeah, absolutely. We're, I think, about out of time here. Does anybody have any final comment or benediction to give the group? Okay. Yeah. Well, great. Thank you very much. Been fun.